from NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And epidemiologists at the University of Washington have revised their projective coronavirus death toll upwards to just over 74,073 people by August. That news comes as more states move cautiously towards lifting social distancing restrictions, and President Trump suggests some schools could reopen soon.
And this morning, President Trump tweeted, "We are doing far more and better testing than any other country." That's only true in number of tests per person. The U.S. is testing less than 2% of the population. Experts say that's not enough. And yesterday, the president unveiled a new testing strategy in a Rose Garden news conference that took the place of yesterday's scheduled daily coronavirus briefing. So let's get some context here from Rick Klein, ABC political director. And Rick, yesterday the president had pharmacy and lab company officials talking about testing, but what are we witnessing here? You know, this wasn't a task force briefing, but it had Dr. Birx from the task force. What are we seeing?
Well, first, you're seeing the closest we've had so far to a national testing strategy, although we still don't have that. We have the federal government working as a testing facility or a testing warehouse of last resort, if you will, but still the states mostly out for themselves. And you also see a White House that's beginning to turn the focus of these regular updates, as regular as they're going to be, from immediate reaction and mitigation into trying to spin forward to a reopening strategy. And I think the optimism that President Trump has brought wrongly early in this crisis is now reflected in these briefings just about every day. Beyond just the statistics and beyond the inflated sense of where we are as a country and where the states are, you're starting to see more details that are aimed at trying to convey that we have turned a corner when the reality is we're very much in the middle of this crisis.
Well, but are we also seeing the president, I don't know, acknowledging what we've been seeing all along, which is that he has sort of taken over, you know, what was supposed to be a task force briefing. Anthony Fauci wasn't in the Rose Garden yesterday. On Saturday, he said the U.S. needed to double its testing over the next several weeks. Dr. Deborah Birx was there, but many are saying that she's not calling out the president when he is wrong. Boston Globe columnist Joan Vinaki, her column was headlined, "Dr. Birx, drape yourself in science, not in Trump-pleasing scarf of denial." So what other kind of shift are we seeing here?
Well, I don't know that you can look at strategy and or find strategy in what the president is doing day to day because it changes so much, frankly. But I do think that a lot of the real work of this task force is not happening in front of the cameras. President Trump, by all accounts, is not even attending a lot of the actual meetings. The public end of it, the president has taken over, and he's taken it over for more than a month now, and often to the consternation of the health officials. And if you ask these health officials about it, look, they recognize that the president goes out on tangents that are wild, that are ill-informed, irresponsible even. They feel like their role, though, is to try to rein it in as much as they can behind closed doors, recognizing this president is going to do what he wants. Like or loathe their strategy, that has been how they have crafted their response, whether it's Dr. Birx or Dr. Fauci. So many of the folks around President Trump have been trying to manage President Trump.
I want to hear a little bit of sound from yesterday. With maybe that in mind, we had the president's tweet yesterday posing the question of why American taxpayers should bail out states and cities, which he said were in all cases Democrat run and managed, seeing the pandemic in blue and red states. And then one reporter, Olivia Nuzzi from New York Magazine, asked President Trump yesterday what his reelection chances should be given the death toll.
If an American president loses more Americans over the course of 6 weeks than died in the entirety of the Vietnam War, does he deserve to be reelected?
So, yeah, we've lost a lot of people, but if you look at what original projections were, 2.2 million, we're probably heading to 60,000, 70,000. It's far too many. One person is too many for this.
Your thoughts on his response, Rick? Measured.
I thought it was measured and also revealing. I mean, he could have flipped off at the reporter, really lost it on him. And I think maybe other presidents might have and said, look, that's inappropriate. He didn't He didn't say what a lot of presidents would say, which is this is not the time to think about politics. He made clear he is thinking about politics. He's thinking about this in terms of his own reelection. He's trying to put the numbers out there that portray his response in a positive light, notwithstanding other things that he has said over a long period of time that would cut in another direction. Politics has been front and center and first and foremost in his mind from the beginning. And the president has been honest about that, actually, throughout, even as he's been dishonest about so many of his characterizations.
Rick, we just have about a half minute. What do you make of the news today? The House will not be coming back to Washington next week, as they announced they would yesterday, because of coronavirus concerns. Some lawmakers are, you know, sleep in their offices, use the House gym. People wondered how that might work. Just a half a minute here.
Yeah, politics is normal. Politics in person is going to have to wait. And I think this is just a bowing to the realities of how things are right here in the District of Columbia, where I am. We are not back to normal. We're not ready for that. And the idea of putting lawmakers and the huge infrastructure around them in danger to hold votes is just not going to happen yet.
Rick Klein, political director at ABC. We always get it all in. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking a lot about the use of technology to track and stop the spread of the coronavirus, and Apple and Google are now releasing more information about their plans to help public health agencies in this effort. Instead of contact tracing, they're now calling it exposure notification. And to explain more about how this will work, we have Sarah Morrison with us. She covers personal data and privacy for Vox. And Sarah, tell us more. What data could your phone be sharing with public health officials?
Sure. So to put it very simply, your phone, if you opted into this program, your phone would send out and receive like Bluetooth signals to and from any other phones that also opted in that were within a certain distance to you. And so basically keeping a record of all the devices you've come in contact with over a certain amount of time. The assumption there is that, you know, those devices are carried by people. And if one of those people tests positive for coronavirus, all the devices that they came into contact with would be alerted that they may have been exposed to coronavirus. So unless you test positive, your phone isn't actually sending any data to the public health officials. And then the Bluetooth signals or keys, which I think is really the only data that's kept on your phone, those are anonymized. So it actually makes it really very difficult to identify somebody through just that Bluetooth signal.
Okay, interesting. So you mentioned the opting in as a feature. When will people start to see this on their phones?
Well, it really depends on if you download the app. So the Apple and Google are making this technology available to public health authorities only. And the idea is that those authorities will develop their own apps, and this would be a part of it. It won't just like appear on your phone. You would go and download that app and then opt in, obviously, and then that would work on your phone. They're not rolling this out until I think mid-May, so that would be the soonest, but it would also just depend on, I guess, if your local public health authority is participating in it and when they develop an app that's out there.
Okay. Well, you know, though, at first Google and Apple were calling this contact tracing. Now they refer to it as exposure notification. Some have really interpreted this change as a response to privacy concerns that many Americans have about the use of technology in this way. Can you talk more about these concerns and maybe what Google and Apple are doing to mitigate them?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are always concerned about, you know, people finding out things about their health, finding out where they've been. Google and Apple have said from the beginning that they had to make this tool as privacy-centric as possible while also still trying to figure out a way to sort of track who people came in contact with. Because this is always been opt-in, you know, it has to be a thing that people are going to use. So the way that they've done this is the signal that your phone sends out is changed, de-identified from your phone. It's changed every 10, 20 minutes. It makes it pretty difficult to connect that back to a specific person. It doesn't take your location data. The data, again, just stays on your phone. It's not sent to public health authorities if you don't trust them with that kind of data. Only public health authorities have access to the technology to make the app. And they're saying the tool is going to just end when the pandemic does, so it couldn't be sort of used for different things.
Yeah, you know that even still the UK's National Health Service has said they'll develop their own tool to do this, as well as health agencies in France. We know there's been a contentious relationship between the UK and these tech companies in the past over privacy issues. Do you have any more insights as to why
there's an apprehension there to use these tech companies in this way in their efforts to help track this virus.
So I think the kind of funny thing is that, like you said, Europe's generally been better about tech and privacy than actually America is. In this particular issue, I think the problem is they think that this tool is a little bit too privacy-centric.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think both the United Kingdom and France wanted the data to go to a centralized server, as in not on the phone, because they don't get any data. I think their public health agencies on, like, you know, where the virus is or who it's coming in contact with. It's basically just the people using it who get that kind of notification. You know, you can see why a health agency would want to know that stuff. So they've gone with their own to try to sort of keep using this Bluetooth exchanging technology and find a way around the limitations of that particular tool.
That's Sarah Morrison. She covers personal data and privacy for Vox. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's here and now, and the coronavirus outbreak has put a strain on cash-strapped hospitals, many of them in rural areas of the country. Mark Holmes has been tracking this impact. He's the director of the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research at the University of North Carolina. Welcome.
Hi, happy to be here. Thanks.
What has this crisis meant for hospitals in rural areas? Have they been inundated at all with these COVID-19 patients?
Well, rural hospitals have had financial challenges for years. We've been tracking closures, for example, since roughly 2005, and 2019 was the highest rate of rural hospital closures since we've been tracking them. Roughly half of rural hospitals lose money in any given year, and so some of them 3 months ago were looking at questions of, can we make payroll on Friday? And so as you cut revenue, you know, some emergency departments are talking about 50% cuts in revenue, and some of the elective procedures that hospitals have been turning away for the last month or so, those are the highest margin services. So they've started off from a tricky situation, and they're seeing their revenue fall, and it's going to be tough for many of them to hold on.
What parts of the country do you think we are seeing the biggest impact to hospitals from this crisis?
So the South has always been one of the more the regions that's faced the tough finances from a rural hospital standpoint. But the nature of this particular crisis is that it goes all across the country. And we've been seeing closures in the Midwest now, for example. And as you look at the maps and see the flare-ups of COVID cases in rural America, you can find one in Indiana and one in Southwest Georgia and, of course, Louisiana and in the mountains. And so these pop-ups are occurring throughout the country, and that makes it every region susceptible.
Your center found that since 2010, so the last 10 years or so, 128 rural hospitals have closed around the country. What was happening to rural hospitals before this crisis? I mean, as far back as 2010?
You can really break the causes of the rural hospital closure crisis into four main buckets. One would be population, and we've seen changes in demographic and population decline. We know rural areas in particular have seen household income fall, and that makes it harder to make deductibles and copayments. There's a policy category that include certainly the ACA and the choice of Medicaid expansion, but sequestration back during the last Great Recession, when we asked hospitals for a 1% give back in terms of Medicare revenue, sometimes that meant the difference between being in the black and being in the red. Payment changes in terms of how healthcare is paid for and structured and delivered have particularly affected rural hospitals because of their volume, and they're more susceptible given their small numbers. And the way that medical practice is delivered, the movement away from inpatient care, the concentration of services away from rural hospitals into urban and often larger facilities. The four of those combine to exacerbate the crisis that they've been facing.
You mentioned the push for patients in more urban areas. Is that the alternative for folks who live in rural areas? And then how is that way of doing things compounded by what we're seeing now with COVID-19?
So sometimes this is driven by decline in services. So as hospitals close their operating room or their maternity ward, that's going to mean that instead of getting your delivering your baby or getting your appendectomy at the local hospital, that means you're going elsewhere. But sometimes this is driven by patient choice and a desire to go to the larger facility, which may be seen as being
a better facility,
more advanced,
yeah.
Right? Which might not always be the case. In terms of COVID, it's really hard to tell because whereas there's some question as to, you know, my local hospital be less likely to have COVID cases, there may be some incentive to staying local. On the other hand, people may respond by going to the larger area that they think can handle a wider variety of cases. And I think we're still waiting and seeing how that's playing out.
You know, some stories that we've been hearing, though, is that many of these rural hospitals, as you mentioned, they're understaffed, but also the ability for them to receive some of the state-of-the-art technology, but then also just some of those basic tools, PPE, face masks, and those types of things. What have you been hearing?
So certainly there's a question of volume purchases. And so if I'm a small rural hospital and I have a 1/20th of the order of a large urban facility, I may have tougher challenges getting that PPE delivered. But I think the other thing to think about, too, is if a hospital has one respiratory therapist, for example, if that therapist gets ill or has a family member who needs to be cared for, now the hospital has zero. And so there's much less room for error in many of these rural facilities.
You know, the president and Congress approved this $30 billion measure to help rural hospitals. Is that expected to help?
I think any time that you have stopgap funding coming in, that's welcome and will be really valuable. The question remains how long this crisis continues. Many indications are that this is a long haul, and that may be a challenge for some of these hospitals to go months under the current scenario, even with this infusion of resources.
Mark Holmes is director of the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research at the University of North Carolina. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's check in now with a small town where the local hospital has come face to face with an outbreak of coronavirus. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie has the story.
The town of Shelby sits on the high plains of north-central Montana. It's home to a lot of wheat and barley fields, a pretty good high school football team, and an Amtrak train that passes through town twice a day.
The people here are fantastic. There's a huge sense of community.
That's William Kiefer. He leads the only hospital in all of Toole County that offers 24/7 emergency services. He says Shelby is a town where most everyone knows everyone. So when folks here started getting sick and even dying from COVID-19, it hit hard.
I mean, I think that everyone's reaction is one of despair.
The virus ripped through the hospital's assisted living facility in late March, infecting more than a dozen staff and residents. As of April 27th, it had killed 6 people in the county. And because Toole County has such a small population, that meant it now has one of the highest per capita death rates from COVID-19 in the entire West. Former Shelby Mayor Larry Bondurant says he knows everyone who passed away.
They all had major health problems. They'd all been sick before.
And now the town, just like the rest of the state of Montana, has been under a strict stay-at-home directive for the past month.
You know, a lot of the Main Street businesses are closed. And, you know, the restaurants are all kind of doing takeout. And I think everybody's adapted to it. Nobody likes it.
Montana's governor plans to slowly lift the stay-at-home directive in phases beginning this week. But Bondurant was against it in the first place. He doesn't think it works. Christine Porter disagrees. She teaches public health at the University of Wyoming and says staying at home is one of the only ways that rural towns like Shelby can protect themselves from the virus.
Left to its own devices, it will spread like wildfire, something we're familiar with.
Rural towns are acutely vulnerable because folks living there are often older and because these towns often have limited medical capacities. For instance, Shelby only has 21 hospital beds and 2 ventilators. But some of the West's small towns aren't taking the threat seriously enough because, unlike Shelby, they aren't seeing many confirmed cases in their counties yet. Porter says this is a frustrating yet common public health dilemma. She explains it using a parable called Babies in the River.
Let's say you're standing by, you know, the river having a nice picnic, and then you see a baby floating by and drowning. What do you do?
Well, you jump in the water and you save it. But then you see another baby floating in the river, and another, and another.
And then there's 1,000 babies in the river that are all drowning. What do? You cannot save all the babies.
She says this is how some rural communities are treating the threat of COVID-19. When there are no babies drowning in their river, they don't see a need to change their behavior so drastically.
Until we see the suffering, we don't believe it and don't think it's worth the cost of the public health measures. Even though once you start seeing the effects in your community, it's not too late to still save some lives, but it's too late to prevent the slam.
Porter is especially concerned about the handful of conservative states that have resisted enacting stay-at-home orders. Those orders, she says, are demonstrably helping to flatten the curve. Back in Shelby, hospital CEO William Kiefer says Montana's stay-at-home directive helped his town wrest control over the outbreak there.
We believe that everyone staying in their homes and doing the following the guidance of the CDC is incredibly important, and that it's, to this point, been very successful in Toole County.
And there's something else that Shelby did that officials should take note of for all future pandemics. Kiefer says the hospital planned ahead before the virus even reached the U.S.
You know, we have a group of dedicated people here that thought, wow, if it does hit the United States, we're a very rural frontier facility and we should do everything in our power now.
All the way back in January, the hospital began purchasing and storing personal protective equipment. That's because even though Shelby, Montana isn't a ski resort or a bustling city, there's that Amtrak train that comes through twice a day between Seattle and Chicago, and the trucks that roll past along the main highway, and the families getting back from vacation.
Although we're small, we're not isolated. People do move around quite a bit.
And in this pandemic, it's that movement that can kill. For Here and Now, I'm Nate Hedgie.
And if you live in a rural part of the United States, let us know how you're doing. Are you worried about whether your hospitals are prepared for an outbreak? Are you staying home instead of seeking care or traveling long distances for care? Let us know at hereandnow.org.
Taiwan is a model for how to handle the pandemic. The island province of 24 million people has just 429 cases. Only 6 people have died. Let's bring in the BBC's Cindy Su on Skype from Taipei. And Cindy, when the outbreak started in China late last year, Taiwan responded quickly. What did the government do?
It did everything that it felt that it had to do, given the lessons that it learned back in 2003 during the SARS outbreak. It firstly closed the borders, so it stopped flights from China, and it also put in travel restrictions for its own people traveling to mainland China. At the same time, they started looking for cases that could be COVID-19 cases, and they did that by alerting all the doctors in all the hospitals in Taiwan and asking them to test for this virus in anybody who has symptoms of flu, symptoms of pneumonia. So, they very quickly found some cases that way. People flying in, including Taiwanese people returning from overseas, they were immediately checked for their temperature. So that helped the authorities catch people who may have the disease.
Well, what about testing? It's, of course, large, 24 million, but in many ways that's relatively small. So has everyone been tested?
No, it actually took a very different approach from countries such as South Korea, which did mass testing. Taiwan has not done that. The fact that they caught the cases so early on and they isolated the confirmed cases as well as quarantined all the people that they had contact with. So even now, we have not had community-wide transmissions. Most of the cases here are actually imported cases. So they haven't had to do mass testing because they've been very good at contact tracing.
So they will find the person that, you know, has the illness, quarantine them, but also go back along that person's path and find everyone that they may have contacted. There's never been a lockdown. The baseball season has started in Taiwan, but people are practicing social distancing, wearing masks.
Yeah, well, life here, you know, looks and feels quite normal, except for the fact that we all have to wear a mask in when we go into, you know, like our buildings, elevators, or, you know, sometimes, you know, in school, some schools require that the kids wear masks throughout the day. Our temperature is checked several times a day. If you go into several buildings, you know, it's checked every time you walk in, from the sports centers to the office buildings, and sometimes the post offices as well. So, you know, it's a very strict sort of system here. And, you know, there are also a lot of vigilantes. People in, you know, for instance, in the community that I live in, people in my building compound who would, you know, remind you to wear a mask when you walk into the elevator and remind you to disinfect your hands.
I have to ask you, Cindy, how do people feel about that, you know, being policed by other citizens?
Well, it can be annoying. I mean, but I heard that it happens everywhere. You know, my sister in California says there are face mask Gestapo out running around. I mean, you don't really need to police the people here. They're very, very compliant. They know the risk involved. As I mentioned, they went through SARS. They don't want it to impact the economy in the same way. It's already impacted. You know, a lot of the tourism industry has been badly affected. So the government has put out these stimulus packages and rescue packages to try to help the businesses and the workers. But on the whole, you know, we've been quite lucky here. Society is functioning. The economy is more or less functioning.
And in a way, we may be looking at our future. You know, temperatures taken before you go into stadiums and things. It's quite something. The BBC's Cindy Hsu from Taipei, Taiwan. Cindy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
City streets in San Francisco are mostly empty these days, residents sheltering at home. Many, as in other cities, living through their second public health crisis. And one group is trying to use lessons learned from the AIDS epidemic to help people stay connected today. From member station KQED, Michelle Pitcher reports.
It was 1985 in San Francisco. Richard Goldman was working as a physician's assistant. He'd moved to the city about 10 years earlier and had met people through his job who were living with HIV and AIDS. Then he got his own diagnosis. He was HIV positive.
I never expected to actually live this long.
Today, Goldman is 71 years old. He lives alone in the middle of the city. He says sheltering in place is incredibly isolating. And on top of that, he can't help but revisit the fear he felt decades ago.
It was terrifying for many, many years during the early AIDS years. And I think those of us who went through it, either as survivors or as caregivers or family and friends, have a fair amount of PTSD from those years. And a lot of that has resurfaced during this COVID pandemic.
HIV attacks the immune system. So does COVID-19. And people with HIV or AIDS are some of the most at risk during the pandemic. They're forced to cut all interactions with the outside world, and all this isolation can have an effect on their physical health. When Goldman was diagnosed with full-blown AIDS in 1990, he knew he didn't want to be alone. He reached out to the Shanti Project, a San Francisco nonprofit that pairs chronically ill patients with companions. The goal is to make sure that no one is socially isolated during a difficult time.
So during those weeks, I was supported 100% on the telephone by one of the volunteer staff. I know how powerful a phone call can be and how important it is to receive them and also to make them.
We know that more people are living by themselves than at any other point in American history.
Kaushik Roy is the executive director of the Shanti Project. The group raises funds through government contracts and donations and uses that money to keep its more than 1,000 HIV-positive clients from being truly alone.
For so many of Shanti's clients, their social network, if you will, are nurses and social workers and doctors, basically people who are just telling them what to do. And oftentimes, Shanti, as a volunteer or staff member, is the one person who shows up just to be and validate and recognize that person's humanity beyond their disease or illness.
Chip Sipanich is almost 60 years old. He has a compromised immune system and a pulmonary issue. He's one of Shanti's clients. He's also living alone.
I am a social person. My home is always my sanctuary, but it has become a prison.
Chip says he lost a lot of friends to AIDS. He says the current situation gives him a funny feeling in his stomach. The fear, the stigma, the prejudice, it all reminds him of a different time.
Stigma in an epidemic situation is something I know all too well. We need to learn to take care of one another.
Sipanich says the most important thing is to stick together, especially in a time when we're all forced apart. For Here and Now, I'm Michelle Pitcher in San Francisco.
Well, under the federal COVID-19 relief packages, the self-employed can now collect unemployment. Usually they're not eligible. Let's see how that's working in Michigan. Those in the personal care industry, like stylists, barbers, makeup artists, are among those who could benefit from this change. Kristen Snyder is a hairstylist in Ann Arbor. She started a change.org petition to raise awareness and funds for people in her industry. And Kristen, it's not as simple as it may sound for people like you to get unemployment. What's been your experience applying in Michigan?
Well, we were actually not able to even begin filing for unemployment until last week. So You can imagine it's been well into a month with no ability to file for unemployment.
Well, let's explain why. Michigan wasn't up and running, and many states aren't up and running with this new aspect of unemployment. You previously hadn't been eligible, and they kind of don't know how to do it right now.
That is correct. And this is an unprecedented thing. So yeah. I think the whole world is a little left behind and scrambling to come up with what to do next.
Yeah, no kidding. And yet we're seeing that states like Georgia opening up hair salons. What do you think about that? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, obviously you've taken a real gut punch, but would you open tomorrow and have people come in?
Well, so here's the funny part. As soon as the states mandate that we can open, we lose our eligibility for unemployment.
All right.
So for us, it's a matter of can we survive choosing to stay unemployed when our states open? And for many of the stylists that I've been talking to in Georgia, they are forced to go back to work because if they don't, they lose their benefit. And they are all very uncomfortable being there, a lot of them because the requirements and recommendations that the state has given out to stylists to open up their businesses and start working is similar to what nurses are wearing in doctors are wearing in hospitals to take care of COVID-19 patients. The amount of PPE that's required and recommended by the state for us to be working is a little bit strange to work in, and to find and source and pay for all on our own, which is, I have very strong opinions about because the healthcare system needs it more than we do.
Oh, what a catch-22. There seem to be so many of them. So you're saying if the state does mandate that you open, you would jeopardize your unemployment. You would go back not really sure of how you could keep things safe because you don't have the equipment right now, the PPE. And I can't even imagine you feeling safe, even with PPE. You work so closely with people. And by the way, would people come in?
I think that there are a handful that I could say absolutely if I were to open tomorrow, they would be there with bells on. I think that there would be a very big struggle, however, to maintain paying things like my salon rent and supplies to do that, because I do think that more people would stay home than not at this point.
Yeah. In the meantime, do you worry that after all this is over, we'll be in a different world?
It will be a slightly different world for a while. I know we're all really used to bustling salons on a Saturday morning, and I think for the foreseeable future, it's going to look much different. It's going to be much more of a one-on-one experience, waiting in your car for your appointment, and potentially washing your own hair, depending on the service you're having, because that's so far what some of the guidelines have looked like for us potentially to reopen.
Wow. Well, you know, we're on a lighter note. We are hearing about, you know, hairstylists, again, who have very close relationships with clients, dropping off packets of hair color, and here's how you do it. But what tips do you have? Because we're also hearing about women saying, you know what, across the board, I'm letting the gray go, I'm letting the hair grow, I'm the heck with my nails, that women are not doing things like this. Do you have tips for women who maybe, you know, would like to do something themselves?
For me, for instance, there are a few people I have that go blonde from pretty dark, and I would never in a million years want them to try and do their own hair. That would be a disaster. So the best thing to do is to reach out to your stylist to see what things you could do comfortably. Other than that, it's a lot of ponytails that we suggest. I know it's hard.
Well, and compared to the big picture, it's really not that, you know, it's not that big a deal. And I just want to say that I would recommend, if you haven't tried a haircut before, try it. I did a couple. It makes you very close with someone, like, you know.
I may or may not have walked my best friend and her teenage daughter through cutting 12 inches off of their hair. That was through a Zoom meeting, no less.
Well, I would
with
just
a pair
say,
of kitchen scissors.
Oh, kitchen scissors. Oh, my God. I hope they were sharp enough. And by the way, mm-hmm. I would just say, if you're cutting a guy's hair, and I was, if you're cutting up around the ear, just pull the top of the ear down.
You're learning so many things.
Less room for
that's
error.
Less ears on the floor. That's pretty much how that works.
It's Kristen Snyder, a hairstylist in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Kristen, thank you so much for filling us in. Thank you, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Your hair stories, leave them at hereandnow.org.
Every year in April, hundreds of thousands of people visit Skagit Valley, Washington for the annual Tulip Festival. The 30-day event brings an estimated $65 million in revenue for the region, except for this year. The festival was canceled because of the coronavirus outbreak. And for more on what this means for farmers in the valley, we have with us Andrew Miller. He's the CEO of the family-owned farm, Tulip Town. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you.
Andrew, I hear the birds chirping out there in the valley. It's a beautiful place. I know this festival started back in 1984, but variations have been happening really dating back to the early 1900s. Your business was projected to make $1 million in April from the festival. It took a lot of time to prepare. How are you guys doing?
Well, we had to pivot really quickly, and we said, hey, we've got some markers that we need to hit to be able to even do this again next year. How can we pivot to create some revenue to be able to do this again? And that put some energy into what otherwise could have been a really, really dark time.
Yeah, you and your family brought this farm from a Dutch couple just in the last year. So this was going to be your big splash, the first year of really experiencing the Tulip Festival. What are some of the ways that you've adapted since this cancellation?
We had very early pivoted to really focusing on technology and some on social media, as well as moving the flowers that we had in the field to people in different ways. Usually we sell bouquets to people that come here. So let's see if we can figure out how to ship them. And then we also.
And how's that working for you guys?
We're learning a lot. We have been overwhelmed by the response from people. We've always wanted to make tulips approachable. And so we sat for a long time and said, does it really cost this much to ship flowers? Because we looked at it and said, $75 for 20 flowers for someone? There's got to be a better way. And so we said, okay, let's use the Postal Service. Let's use UPS. So we just continued to test and iterate until we found, you know, a solution that we really love exporting the beauty and the hope and the joy of spring here in the Skagit Valley around the country.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, this is prime buying season with Mother's Day coming up. I also know that raising tulips is a year-long crop. They bloom in April. This is why this is a big month for Skagit Valley. I've been to the festival many times. It's amazing to see so many colors of tulips that run for miles. So what happens to all of the tulips that you don't sell or you can't ship out now?
So what we've done is we'll top the tulips. So what we'll do is this week, really, we started topping in earnest. And so we have about 30% of our field right now that's just in color. And so we take the tops off. The plant then will focus on strengthening the bulb for harvest here in the next 3 to 4 weeks. We'll move into harvesting.
So those pictures where we see where the tulips have been topped off, it seems heartbreaking because you're thinking they're topped off, but that actually helps the individual flower.
It does. We call it a life-saving surgery because if we didn't do that, they would die. So what happens is because we plant so thick, again, the leaves would fall down into the foliage, or the petals, rather, would fall down into the foliage, and then they could invite disease, which would get down into the bulb, which would actually, you know, destroy the flower. So we top it to separate the parts of the flower that are good for the flower. But I will admit, there's some of my favorite flowers out there that I just can't watch when they're topping them.
I can imagine. How has this changed or strengthened your relationship with other farmers? Because you kind of all come together for this wonderful festival and work together. I know that you are shipping out flowers, as you mentioned, but that can't really make up for the revenue of folks who are coming to visit.
No, it doesn't. We say, you know, people ask us if we're a bulb farm or if we're a flower farm, and ultimately we're a smile farm. We are about connecting, and we have a lot of phenomenal farmers, but there are only two bulb farms. You know, there are two commercial growers of tulips left in the valley, and so we do have to rally around what it means for our community. You know, it's been great. People come up to the farm stand, and we've sold, you know, tulips to our neighbors and people that might have stayed away before. And so it really has been a different part of our business model to connect. And we've always, you know, relied upon our community. We purchased Tulip Town because tulips are so iconic.
You have this campaign now, Color for Courage. What exactly is that? And what are you asking people to do?
You bet. So Color for Courage is an opportunity for anyone really around the world to purchase a bouquet. And so we use a lot of the relationships that we have to take these tulips and take 200 tulips, bouquets of tulips into a hospital, into Madigan Army Medical Center, or into a nursing home here in our community where people just love tulips.
Do you think the tulip industry in Skagit Valley will survive? Will there be a next year?
There will be a next year. How that comes about, we'll still have to see. We're not entirely sure on how that will shake out. But we know here at Tulip Town that I'll be growing tulips here at Tulip Town next year.
That's Andrew Miller. He is the CEO of Tulip Town. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you for helping us to tell our story.
And to see more images of these spectacular tulips, go to hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.